Okay, Boker Tov, everybody, or Tzoraim Tov in Israel. But people are saying Tehillim every day and Shul, of course, since October 7th. And I don't know, this morning, I don't know what Tehillim is. Say, maybe we should say hello for what happened, because I think it was sort of a nice nigla that, considering, what I heard in Shul last night, right before Mincha, that there were attacks from Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and it's all over the place. And thank God, after Shabbos ended, we turned on the news. It was, much better. So let's hope this is the beginning of the Gula Shlema in Nisan Nigalu and Nisan Atidin Ligal. Okay, time to start
Okay.
our beginning of our Haggadah Shel Pesach Yom Iyun, and Yael Leibowitz, who made Aliyah recently, relatively recently, will lead us off very quickly. Yael, graduate of Columbia, taught at Ramaz and Stern, and now teaches at Matan and is working on a book in Ezra and Nehemiah. And it's 9:15, so Bavakasha, it's all yours.
You got it. Okay. So first of all, good morning to everyone who's not in Israel, and good afternoon to everyone here. I imagine anyone here who is listening in did not sleep much last night. So, okay. So actually, just echoing what you just mentioned, when we're asked to speak about Pesach, so for the most part, it's usually a relatively easy thing. You look through the Haggadah, there's lots of Divrei Torah, there's lots of things that are relevant and exciting, and Pesach is always sort of an exciting time of the year, the spring, the renewal, everything we associate with Pesach. I don't have to tell anyone tuning in that this year, talking about Chirut, when we have hostages still being held underground, when we have soldiers who aren't getting out for Pesach because they're busy out on the front lines protecting us. So talking about Chirut, for me personally, was something that was a struggle on some level, just to think about how to sort of encapsulate what this Pesach is really all about. It's filled with all of these sort of paradoxical emotions. And so I actually drew, ironically, I drew actually strength from looking way back in time at how Pesach is something that over the course of time really became redefined based on the needs of the Jewish people in each generation. I don't have to tell anyone here, we start the whole Seder with Kadesh or Chatz, Karpatz, Yachatz. We go through the entire Haggadah. And I imagine most people here know that that really was the Pesach Seder wholesale was an invention of Chazal's invention as a means of commemorating the Korban Pesach, as a means of commemorating what the Chag was when the Beit HaMikdash stood, and creating a Chag that can withstand Galut, that could withstand being in all different places and all different times without having that tether of the Mikdash, and to create meaning in a different way through the experience of Magid, through the rituals that were created to sort of recollect and recall things from an earlier time. And so one of the things that I wanted to share with you today is actually way, way prior to Chazal's sort of redefinition, if we want to call that, of Pesach itself, and go back actually thousands of years before that even, and look at a Pesach where things were redefined in a much more subtle way, but I think in a way that can help us sort of reframe how we think about Pesach this year, when, again, as I mentioned, there are so many conflicting emotions pulling at our hearts simultaneously. So the story starts 3,000 years ago, actually, in the period of King Chizkiyahu. King Chizkiyahu was one of the last of the Judean kings, for those of you that are familiar. And one of the things that we know, and he's actually not just one of the last kings, but also one of the few righteous kings from the dynasty of David, that Melachim remembers him as one of the, most righteous. David becomes the barometer in Sefer Melachim for righteousness. And Chizkiyahu is remembered as one of the most righteous, like David Aviv, is the refrain that the Tanakh always goes back to. And if you just look, if I could direct you to sources, source one, it says, Chizkiyahu ben Achaz, and it lists them, and it gives sort of the standard listing of the king and the years that he was ruling, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the most important things really that happened in Chizkiyahu's reign that he's most remembered for in the period of Melachim, or in the book of Melachim, certainly, it says in Pasuk Gimel there in the first sources, Aviv. And what does that mean? That he did what was righteous in God's eyes, Moshe Ad Hayamim Ahem, Hayu B'nei Yisrael Mekadrim Lo. etc., etc. So Chizkiyahu is well known for essentially getting rid of, eradicating. Now, of course, we know it wasn't hermetic, but eradicating all of the Avodah Zarah, all of the foreign worship that Israel had been worshiping, really, the Tanakh is pretty explicit, from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu and on, trying to abolish foreign worship in the land of Israel, and more specifically in Yerushalayim, and bringing everyone back to sort of recalibrating the people and bringing them back to this loyal, pure monotheistic worship. Okay? And that's one of the things that he's most well known for, certainly in Sefer Melachim. What's interesting, though, is that if we fast forward to Divrei Hayamim, which is on your source two, there's an additional component to that story. Okay, so if you look in sources, Divrei Hayamim, and again, for those of you who are familiar with the Sefer, Divrei Hayamim essentially recalls all of Israel's history up until the Cyrus Proclamation in 539 BCE, but it's written in the Second Temple, in the early Second Temple period, during the period of Shivat Zion. And one of the things that's interesting is that Divrei Hayamim sort of retells past events, but it does so, as we're going to talk about today, through a really, really important sort of polemical lens, we might say. And it tweaks, or it makes changes, or either adds or detracts from things that we think we already know from Sefer Melachim. So if you look in source two there, right, it starts with that same basic formula, Yechizkiyahu Melach ben 25 shana ve'esrim b'teisha shana Melach b'Yerushalayim. And it talks again there about how he was pure, and he tells in Pasuk Hey, I bolded the Pasukim that are relevant. Just, again, we don't have a lot of time. I'm sticking to my 29 and a half minutes. So I'm just going to read the important highlights, or the important Pasukim. It mentions there also in Sefer Divrei Hayamim that the Israelite people had been, you know, sort of disloyal to God all those years, and so he was bringing everyone back into the fold, so to speak. Okay, and it's interesting, if you jump down to source three, here's the part that is not mentioned in Sefer Melachim that I think can actually serve as an inspiration for today. It says in source three, Pasuk Aleph, it says, Vayishlach Chizkiyahu al kol Yisrael v'Yuda, v'gam igrot katav al Ephraim u'Menashe, lavo leveit Hashem b'Yerushalayim, lasot Pesach l'Hashem elokei Yisrael. So he invites everyone to do... Sorry, is that a question? He invites everyone to Yerushalayim to celebrate Pesach. Okay, now I'm not going to waste too much time referring you back, but one of the things that we notice in the bolded pasuk in the paragraph right above in Pasuk Tet Zayin is that it tells us that the purification of the Mikdash started, it says in Yud Zayin up there, by Achelu Be'echad L'Chodesh HaRishon, Aleph Nisan L'Kadesh, Uv'yom Shmoneh L'Chodesh Ba'u L'Ulam Hashem, V'Kadshu Et Beit Hashem L'Yamim Shmonah. Okay, so the 8 days of cleaning and the second phase, which took another 8 days, which means Uviyom Shisha Asar L'Chodesh HaRishon Kilu. They only finished on Tet Zayin Nisan, which is already into the holiday of Pesach. Okay, so they come to Chizkiyahu and they come to Yerushalayim, and Chizkiyahu says that we should, you know, it's time to celebrate Pesach. Pasuk Bet says, "Vayivat Hamelach v'Sarah v'chol haKahal b'Yerushalayim la'asot haPesach b'Chodesh Hasheni." So they have this idea, and they sort of suggest to the king and to all his advisors that maybe they should do it that year instead of doing it in Nisan, to do it in Sivan Chodesh Hasheni. And they explain, "Ki lo yachlu la'asot to ba'etahi, ki haKohanim lo hitkadshu l'midai v'ha'am lo ne'esku b'Yerushalayim." And they give two reasons why they can't do it. They said the Kohanim were not pure, had not purified themselves sufficiently, and the nation had not yet, right, they hadn't yet congregated in Yerushalayim. Okay, so if I were to throw out the question for anyone who has studied the halachot of Pesach, and I said to you, what's the precedent for this suggestion? I think most of us would jump to the obvious location in Bamidbar. You have it there on your sources, source four. In Bamidbar Perek Tet, the famous episode where people come to Moshe. Moshe announces, there you have it in Perek Tet. So Pasuk Gimel is bolded, that on the 14th day of Nisan is when they have to do the Pesach. But then people approach Moshe, right? We have a couple of cases in the Midbar where people approach Moshe and they sort of give him an unprecedented hypothetical, and Moshe has to turn to God and ask him how to respond halachically, right? But Korbanot Slach. That is another great example of this type of scenario. So in Pasuk Ted, it says, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe l'emor, and he, Hashem, so these people come and they ask a question. They say, hold on a second. What happens if someone is Tamei? Or, and I'm going to read you the Pasuk inside, Daber el Bnei Yisrael l'emor, Ish ish ki hiya tamei lenefesh, right? If someone is tamei lamet, and so he is forbidden to bring the korban, o bederech rechok halachem, right? Or if he's, it's too far away and he can't get to the mikdash in time, o ledor techem, ve'asa pesach la'ashem, b'chodesh hasheni, b'arba asar yom, bein ha'arbayim, yasu oto, al matzot merorim yochlu. Right? So Hashem allows, and again, it makes sense because, right, the Pesach is not just a holiday. Pesach is in many ways sort of the foundation of our faith. Hashem, the Aseret HaDibrot begin with the words, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, right, Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, and therefore, Lo Yelcha Elohim Acherim. Right, the Exodus from Egypt and the commemoration of the Exodus from Egypt is really the foundation or the pillar of everything we believe. And so Hashem says, anyone who's unable to do it for those two reasons the first time around in Nisan, no problem, bring the Korban the next month. Okay, so again, at first blush, we imagine that's what was happening in the days of Chizkiyahu. And yet, one of the things that's very, very interesting, and I'm just going to pull you back, my apologies, but I have to pull you back up to the top of the page a little bit higher for a second, is that if you look back right there where it's bolded in the top of the page, that's from, here you go, from Perek Divrei Hayamim Perek Lamed, I'm starting with Pasuk Tet Vav there. Okay, there's two very interesting things that we noticed. It says, "Vayishchatu haPesach b'arba'asar l'chodesh hasheni, v'akohanim v'alevim nichlemu v'yitkadshu." So the Kohanim and the Levim, they purify themselves. Vayaviu olot beit Hashem, and then it goes on. It says, "Vayamdu al amdam k'mishpatam k'torat Moshe." It explains that what they're doing is, you know, sort of in the keeping alive the tradition or the halachot of Moshe, which was a very prominent theme in Second Temple literature. And then it goes on and it says, "Hakohanim zorkim et adam niyad halevim ki rabat pakahal asher lo yitkadshu." Okay, so it's very, very interesting. It's saying that they had to sort of be the proxies for the people to bring Beit HaMikdash because most of the people had not yet purified themselves. Okay, so if we're saying that the first, right, the precedent that we have, or what we imagine to be the precedent in Sefer Bamidbar, that someone who's not pure can bring it a month later. But here, that doesn't solve the problem because the people are still impure. And so why are we pushing it off by a month? And the next question, which I think, you know, I sort of alluded to up a little bit earlier, is that the halacha of Pesach Sheni is that you keep Pesach the first time around in Nisan, right? You don't eat chametz, right? Pesach is commemorated in Nisan, but for the few stragglers or the few people that were left on the outs the first time around, so then they have a makeup date to bring the korban. But what we find here in Chazal, and I'm not going to get into all the interpretations of Chazal, some of them try to explain that it was a leap year and that's why Pesach was deferred. But if we look at what was happening in Divrei HaYamim Perek Lamed, it wasn't that they were saying, okay, we're going to celebrate Pesach in Nisan and then the few people who need to bring the Korban can bring it later. The entire holiday of Pesach, the whole issue of Chametz and the whole issue of Korban and the whole issue was pushed off by an entire month, meaning it was canceled essentially in Nisan, which again is very, very difficult for us to wrap our heads around, and pushed off into Nisan. Okay? And so what we want to sort of ask is, A, what's going on, right? Where is this coming from? And I think also perhaps to sort of try to answer that question, the second question or the question that really dovetails is, why is it only mentioned in Divrei HaYamim? This seems like such a bizarre or maybe exciting potentially scenario. Why is it not mentioned at all in Sefer Melachim? And yet it's mentioned here and it's a pretty big deal in Divrei HaYamim. So in order to answer this, and there's a professor, Glatt Gilad, has I think really one of the most interesting explanations to how to explain this sort of the discrepancy between the two Sarim as to what really happened and also try to explain it. And he says that we really have to take the context into account, right? Chizkiyahu, we know, I mentioned that he was one of, right? The later Judean kings. He ruled during the period where there were a series of exiles from the northern kingdom, right? We know that after the days of Shlomo, in the days of David and Shlomo, it was a united kingdom. You had all the 12 tribes essentially united, at least in theory. And then after Shlomo's son, you have that split where there's the 10 tribes go up north, and then it's not really exactly 10 tribes, but where majority of the tribes go up north and break up into the northern kingdom, and then you have the southern kingdom in the south. Okay, now one of the things, and Chizkiyahu, and that's how it was really for the majority of the first temple period, from the days of Rechavam and Yeravam and on. And one of the things that we don't like to talk about a lot, because we like to sort of imagine our history, I think, rose-colored glasses sometimes, is that there was tremendous enmity, not always, but at many, many points throughout that period, there was tremendous enmity and, competition is not even the right word, really antagonism between the north and the south. And when Chizkiyahu was ruling, when this was happening, the sort of rehabilitation of the cult in the days of Chizkiyahu happened just during and in the aftermath of the exile of the northern tribes out of the land of Israel. Okay. Now, if we look in Sefer Melachim, one of the things that's really, really interesting is that when Sefer Melachim, and again, I'm keeping an eye on the time, so there's going to be psukim that I just say out loud, I apologize, instead of reading inside, but they're all there, I assure you. One of the things that if we read Sefer Melachim, makes very clear about the exile is twofold. The first thing Sefer Melachim seems to imply is that everyone was exiled, that it was sort of this broad, sweeping, all-encompassing exile, and no one was left in the north, and in the place of the northern tribes, the Assyrians, we know this story, brought in foreigners to sort of fill the space and work the land, but no one from those northern tribes were left in the land. That's the first sort of, I would say, detail or nuance of the story that Sefer Melachim seems to present. The second nuance, and you have it there in Perek Yud Zayin, is there's a phrase in Israel. It's really actually pretty obnoxious, but kids use it all the time. So it's magia lahem, okay, which basically means like you deserve it, right? One kid smacks another kid, the other says magia lecha, right? Like, just again, really obnoxious. But one of the things that we find in Sefer Melachim is a sense. Okay. And again, I'm saying this carefully because I don't want it to sound irreverent, but a sense from the Southern Empire that the Northerners were exiled because magia lahem. And you see there in Pasuk Chaf, it lists, it says, Vayim as Hashem b'chol zera Yisrael, Vayan name, Vayit name b'yad shosim, right? Hashem allowed them to fall into the hands of the enemy. Why? Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Ki kara Yisrael me'al beit David, Vayam lichot Yeravam ben Nevat, Vayidach Yeravam et Yisrael me'acharei Hashem. And they sort of see, right, again, to misappropriate, you know, to appropriate a term, the original sin of the Northern Empire was that they broke away from the Davidic Empire, and then they led all of Israel astray to foreign worship. And so whatever happened to them was a sort of complete, final, and it's what they deserved. Okay. That's the perspective in Sefer Melachim. Okay. For that reason, one of the things that Chizkiyahu sort of had to do when he, in the aftermath of that exile, was to then centralize worship in Yerushalayim, make sure that all the bamot were gone, make sure that all of the negative influences were gone, and then sort of restructure and ensure that, as we mentioned a couple of minutes ago, pure monotheistic worship was back where it belonged. Okay? Now, Divrei Hayamim, what's interesting, has a very, very different take on what happened with the exile. Okay. And I'm going to have to skip my chart, even though it's really cool, but I can't run over time. Okay. Divrei Hayamim presents in many ways Chizkiyahu as a second Shlomo, so to speak, right? That's what you could see on your charts. They make lots of linguistic parallels between Chizkiyahu and Shlomo, and they see him in many ways as this person who could both, you know, bring worship back to Yerushalayim where it belongs and bring monotheism back where it belongs, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things that we're going to see Divrei Hayamim also presents differently is that they don't see the exile as absolute. If you look in Divrei Hayamim, one of the things that's interesting, and I brought here source 6, is back from Divrei Hayamim Lamed. When they decide to make Pesach a month later, look carefully in Pasuk Vav over there. It says as follows, Vayelchu haratzim v'igrot miyad hamelech v'sarav v'chol Yisrael v'yudah u'chemitzvat hamelech l'mor. Right? They send out all the language you might see is sort of similar to the language from Megillat Esther, where we have the improved road systems and letters and literacy, et cetera, et cetera. And it says as follows, okay? It says, Lemor, the message from the king says, B'nei Yisrael, Shuvu el Hashem Melokei Avraham Yitzhak v'Yisrael, V'yashov el ha-pleita, Hanish'eret lachem nikaf malchei Ashur. Okay, this is not the picture we get in Sefer Melachim, where we imagine the land was emptied of all the Israelim. Here, there's a different sense that there were people that were left, and not just were they left, but that Chizkiyahu requests that they come down and that they join them and that they let go of the mistakes of the past, but that they come to Yerushalayim, and just like he's making this religious reform for the people in Malchut Yehuda, that they too should benefit from that beautiful reform. Okay. Now, I will, again, I'm not going to read it inside in the interest of time, but quickly, when you have time on your own, read through the sources. One of the things you'll notice is that it wasn't as peachy as we might imagine. There were still some tensions, and the people were making fun of the messengers that were coming to them. And so the tensions, you get the sense, are still there, but Chizkiyahu insists that unity is something that needs to happen. Okay, even if it wasn't perfect. And so one of the things we notice, and by the way, this is not unique to just this topic. Again, I don't have time for it, but look in your charts. You'll notice that consistently, one of the things, sorry about that, that Divrei HaYamim does is it presents certain topics in a way that are very, very, or not very different, but just subtly different enough from Lachim that it forces us to question, right? What is this? What is the author of Divrei HaYamim trying to communicate? So, you know, the most famous example that's not relevant to this conversation is David HaMelech, right? Sefer Shmuel, for example, presents all of the sins, explicit sins of David HaMelech, and how he did Shuvah in the aftermath of those sins. But it's honest about the sins that David HaMelech did. Divrei HaYamim sort of glosses over them. Okay. And again, it's not a question of trying to rewrite history or ignore the mistakes of our past. Divrei HaYamim knew that Sefer Melachim existed, but it's more a way of creating an idealized past so that the people living through the period that the author of Divrei HaYamim is living through have something to strive for. It almost gives them sort of a benchmark. And so one of the things we notice in these other sources is that Divrei HaYamim, for example, where you have other Sfarim in Tanakh and Sefer Shoftim and Sefer Shmuel and Sefer Melachim, where there's tension between the different tribes, all the different examples, you can look again on your own time at the chart. Divrei HaYamim doesn't do that. It doesn't talk about the intertribal tensions in that way. Okay, I'm going to jump down. You have also many of the episodes that happened in that seem to only deal with the southern empire in Sefer Melachim. In Sefer Divrei HaYamim, much like the example of the second Pesach, the northerners are invited to participate. There's a sense of trying to draw them back into the fold. Okay, and you have, again, another example that you could look at on your own time are the absorptions of foreigners. People that are not mentioned in Melachim as again, I'm going to use the word conversion, right? Converting, even though it's not, it's sort of anachronistic because conversion meant something else in the biblical period. But the foreigners that Sefer Divrei HaYamim absorbs into the people of Israel also speaks to this sort of overarching attempt of the author to communicate something to Israel. Okay. And to his audience. And so, I will say one of the questions that often comes up when we ask, right? Well, one sefer has this account of things and another sefer has this account of things. Which one was it? And I always say to my students, I brought a quote there from a historian. It says, history is not the past, but a map of the past drawn from a particular point of view to be useful to the modern traveler. The example I always like to use with my students, I say, you take a room full of people and you blindfold them and you stick them standing, all of them standing around an elephant. And everyone is touching a different part of the elephant. One of them, but they're all blindfolded and they don't know that they're touching the same thing. And so one person has his eyes closed and the blindfold, and he says, you know, I feel something sort of, you know, shy, smooth and pointy at the end. It almost feels like something like a bone. And another person who's touching the side of the elephant will say, it feels really hard and leathery. I'm not really sure what I'm touching. And the person at the end will say, it almost feels like a rope, right? So if someone were to say, well, who's right? They're all right. They're all touching different parts of the elephant. One of the things that I think is so important when we learn Tanakh to recall and to remember, and I think it's so important this year of all years to remember, is that there's no one truth. Well, there are certain things that we insist are truths, right? But when we're talking about interpreting history, when we're talking about what happens, we're not asking which one is right. What we're always asking when we study Tanakh is, what does this author, this specific author, writing about this specific episode from that moment in history, want his audience to understand? Right? History is never just about what happens. It's the means by which we understand our present and try to fashion our future. try to shape our future based on our understanding of the things that went right and the things that went wrong. For Sefer, the author of Sefer Melachim, there was still so much enmity when he was writing between the North and the South, and all the old resentments were still there, and they were valid, but they were still palpable. The author of Divrei Hayamim had the hindsight. He had already been out to Galut. He had already been out, and he had seen what happens when we don't have the strength of unity. He saw how after the Northern Empire fell apart, so did the Southern Empire. And one of the things that the author of Divrei Hayamim believes more than anything is that in order to do it right the second time around, we have to prioritize unity. And so he brings this crazy episode where the holiday of Pesach was canceled and reinstated a month later. And in many ways, what we see is that the author of Divrei Hayamim is saying the cult is important and ritual is critical and restoring our religion and restoring the Davidic king. And all of those things are very, very important components of our history. But if we are going to learn anything, the author of Divrei Hayamim says, from our past, and if we are going to draw any useful messages from what we met, what we did wrong the first time around, then this time around, we have to be sure to include everyone, not because we agree with them, but because as a Jew, and this is what the Tanakh is insisting by incorporating 24 different books with 24 different opinions, that as a Jew, I have to always acknowledge that the person standing next to me, even though they feel differently, it just means that they're touching a different part of the elephant. And so, you know, again, I think that I said that I struggled with trying to find a message this year for Pesach as we sit down with our families and we sing the Kaddish Orchat and we're sort of going through the rituals that feel so old and feel so traditional. And yet this year feels so sort of discordant with maybe what we're feeling inside. But I think that in many ways, if we remember that just like the Seder was an advent of Rabbinic Judaism in many ways, that Pesach has always been a point in history where people look at it and say, what can this holiday teach the people today about what went wrong in the past and what went right? Right? Pesach is actually, it's interesting if you think about it, and I know I have a minute. Pesach is one of the only holidays where we don't just commemorate what God did for us. Right? We don't just remember that God built the Sukkot and we sat in them in Mitzrayim. Pesach is the holiday where we actually recall what we did. The choice we made to shape the future of Israel. We remember that we didn't have time for the matzot to bake because we were taking that stand and we were expressing that conviction that the future of the Israelite people is contingent on us and our behaviors and our decisions and our choices. And so I think that, you know, if we could sort of hold that in our minds and realize that as much as tradition is stable and consistent, it's not static. And no Pesach is going to feel the same way the last Pesach did, and it's not going to feel this way next Pesach. But I think that if there's one thing we learn from the way that Pesach was used in the past, in Tanakh particular, is that Pesach is a time not just to thank Hashem for the miracles that happened in the past, but to reflect as a community on what we need to do as a community to improve and what we need to do as a community to ensure that the Geula that we are waiting so desperately for is within our grasp. And so I think that, you know, I think if perhaps in earlier years we had the luxury or in sort of, you know, the golden age of the Jewish era in America and in Israel, we had the luxury of being able to take the stand on some level of Sefer Melachim and say that we are right and they are wrong and they're the reason that we're having trouble and they're the reason that I think that this year more than ever, we have been reminded that we no longer have that luxury. We no longer have the luxury to look at other people within our nation and blame them for what's going wrong. But we have to, at all costs, sort of draw on the inspiration of the author of Divrei Hayamim and realize that the only thing we can do every time that inclination rises is to close our eyes and remember that the people I strongly, vehemently disagree with are holding, touching a different part of the elephant. They too are committed to the future of the Jewish people. They too want that Geula to come. And I think that if we can internalize that and draw from the inspiration of Chizkiyahu Hanavi, then as we sit down at the Seder around the table with our family, with Kadesh, Ochatz, Karpas, Yachatz waiting for us, then I think we'll be able really to grow from the experience and in that merit, God willing, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Atzileinu Mi'adam once again. Thank you.
Okay.